Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to the show. This is Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. That would be Mr. Briscoe, whichever direction he is. I am Bradshaw, and we've got a groundbreaking trailblazer and by far the best thing to ever come out of Oklahoma and the best looking thing to ever be named Mike, by far, too. Mike McGurk, thanks for joining the show.
Hey, thank you for the invitation. Isn't this great? And before we go any further, I might be a little better looking than JR, but there's a couple of us that came out of Oklahoma, but I'm going to hold the female title, okay?
That's for sure. And that Jim Ross, he can't hold a candle, you Mike. Come on now.
Hey, Briscoe, look out.
Hey, Lewis.
There's not a time that I can't go by Blackwell, Oklahoma, you know. And also I'm going to tell a little story before we get started about Briscoe's. My dad and my mom were in the car and we'd be coming from a cattle sale because of my dad's ranch. And we got stopped. My mom's driving, of course. And of course, my dad had been sleeping in the back. And the whole story, every time any kind of officer pulled us over, my dad would rise out of the back. And of course, immediately he would turn the heat on my mother, and he would, is this a daytime or nighttime show? But I don't know. But anyway, he would say, God dang it. You know, can't you see I'm blind here? And he says, I've got this son of a gun up here driving for me that obviously doesn't observe the speed limit. And he goes, where in the hell are we anyway, officer? And he'd say, well, you're just outside of Blackwell. There went the Briscoe stories right there. And before you know it, we had to promise a Briscoe brother's picture to be sent to him so we could scoot. So, yes, thank you for that.
Well, I'm glad I got you out of that ticket, but let me jump in there quick. A couple of years ago, back before all this crap hit our country, the last WrestleMania that I was at, the Hall of Fame, and so I kept watching. I was sitting there at the end of the front row, and I kept glancing over, and I kept seeing Linda McMahon, bending over, looking at me, saying, you know, like afterwards, I need to talk to you. And I'm thinking, what the hell did I do this time? You know, we're Linda McMahon during the damn Hall of Fame ceremony, making a point that I see her telling me that she needs to talk to me afterwards. And I'm sitting there, I'm going through my mind, you know, what did I do? What did I say? You know, because I'm a loudmouth. I'd say things I shouldn't say sometimes. And I get a little crazy when I'm around JBL and that beverages start flowing. So I'm running through the week, you know, trying to figure it out. I know I didn't do anything wrong. So here it comes. The last speech is over with. And all of a sudden I look, and here comes Linda McMahon almost trotting down to say hello to me. She said, oh, I've been wanting to see you. And at that time, she was serving our country as a small business administrator. So
right. She
was in Oklahoma after one of the storms. And she was in Oklahoma and happened to go through Blackwell. Well, Blackwell, the Army there has the museum, and it says drop in and see Blackwell's own Briscoe brothers. She made this whole damn caravan of government people turn around and go into this armory and see this little display of the Briscoe brothers, hometown Blackwell, Oklahoma. And I was in there, and she couldn't wait to tell me all the stories that she had about me when I was 7, 8 years old. But I thought that was so funny. Here's Linda, you know, one of the most important people in the country, sure. You know, wanting to tell me that she'd been to Blackwell and been to the Museum Hall of Fame where she saw Jack and I's pictures. So,
isn't that great?
Thank you, Blackwell.
I know. And I even, you know, all those little towns, Perry, you know, and God rest his soul, man. Danny, you know, you
we're
can't.
We're going to get in some of the Hodge stories there. So, but you know, it's so remarkable. All like you say, all those little towns there, they had so many heroes and everything. And, you know, it's like small town USA. I mean, you drive through any of them. You know, even where John's in the Abilene Christian Hall of Football Hall of Fame. So yeah. we're sitting here with Hall of Fame royalty with John there. So, but it's not like Blackwell, Oklahoma.
You know? No, that's right. That's Thank right. Goodness. Nothing can compare. No.
You know, one thing that
Go ahead. Why didn't they make Blackwell capital of Oklahoma? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure.
It was the first place that those damn cheating Sooners went to. Imagine that you name your school the Sooners. Now, what are the Sooners? They're the damn cheaters, right, John?
I completely agree.
Yes.
You know what the Sooner is, right? They're those damn people that went before the boom, you know?
That's right. They cheated.
They went down and stole all the land, but they went to Norman, thank goodness. They didn't stop for the good land. they were so greedy, they wanted to go all the way down there. But anyway.
Well, they can stay down there where the tornadoes are. You know, that's a good place for them.
Well, one thing we all have in common here is we all dislike OU. So you guys are from the good part of Oklahoma, and you are just like us in Texas. We dislike that one school from Norman, Oklahoma. So don't even try to tell me, Gerald Briscoe, you don't root against OU like I do.
Anytime
that OSU is playing anybody, you know, and OU, I'm for Texas. And you can just know that I'm rooting for Texas. So, you know, it's never for OU. So
never an issue.
I am for Texas. Well, I'm telling you, it is just a pleasure to be on your all show. And we're going to have some fun. And I know you're going to spark some things, just like you were talking about Blackwell and the people that came out of Oklahoma. And we can't forget, you know, I've got a picture here that hangs on the wall of shame, but this is a wall of fame for me. It's where, you know, whose dad's wrestling coach was. Do you know that? You remember who Coach Daddy had? You know, when people say, well, when did your dad graduate? Well, I was a late child. You know, I came even later sometimes. But he graduated in 33. So his coach, you know, and that was the only sport that would take my father, because he was born with two eyes, and then was, you know, he had an eye kicked out by an accident where a kid was swinging, what I understand was swinging. You grab these rings and then you would swing out over the swimming pool, and the kid got scared. And my dad was up on the diving board and had his head turned, and it was just one of those freak accidents. He was a poor old boy. So back in the day, you know, let's see, Daddy was born 1910, so this might have been the 20s. That was the only thing they could do is take it out. So he had to be pretty tough for that. And the only sport that would take him was wrestling. So that's how he met. Earlier we were talking about a fellow that had wrestled with my dad and had gone to school with him back in the days of Central High School, was Jack Gott. And so anyway, my dad went on to A&M, OSU, and that's how he started his wrestling career. He didn't mean to keep wrestling because his love was journalism. And, you know, he had I majored in journalism with a minor in psychology. I was doomed from the start with that kind of, like, oh God. But, you know, he could write. He could, you know, he wrote all the stories, the bios, the color of the guys. But he could sit down at the typewriter And I know anybody ever walked into his office and he was at there at that typewriter, that journalism mind was kicking in. Because he
witnessed about myself in the old Kane's ballroom, that office he had in the Kane's there, the typewriter sat right at his desk. The first time I walked in there was with Jack, and I noticed that typewriter there. And you know, I mean, we all took typing. You learn the keys, but you know, to do that professionally, basically what he was doing, because he was doing the write up for the newspapers and everything. I said, Jack, why the hell have you got a new typewriter? And he writes everything. Like, wow. And the other night I was looking up a bio and I noticed Danny Williams. Now, Danny Williams, as you and I know, and John don't know this, but Danny Williams was one of the most famous TV personalities ever in the history of Oklahoma TV. But he later became one of the most popular DJs in the history of Oklahoma. And his broadcast partner, do you remember who his broadcast partner was on radio? Jim Weaver.
Who was it?
Jim Weaver,
Del Weaver,
who is Skandor Akbar's real name, was Danny Williams' morning drive partner, John, on radio back when we were kids.
I had no
idea. Watch out for flying chairs.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
That was how he would close the show, is watch out for flying chairs. But he, you know, he also looked at it from a fan's perspective. You know, not only was he doing the job, but he was a fan and loved wrestling. But he was.
You could tell in this interview, he was a huge fan. I mean, even signed off with putting the wrestlers over. You know, it's not an F word as you think it is, and it's not as real as you think it is. But these guys, they're the real deal. They're the real athletes and everything. But what a deal. But your dad was a national champion back in 32, I believe it was, or 33, yes. Something like that.
Yep. And three times, you know, some of these pictures are great where, you know, he wrestled different classes, had to. And
yeah, your dad was only like a middleweight. He was 140 pounds when he first started, I think, in college. Then he went up to 177, I believe it was. But that's quite a jump for those middleweight guys and to win the national tournament and be All-American all those years, you know, or something. But your dad, eventually, when he got out of college, did you ever talk to your dad how he made that switch over? He did, was it just during that time where he needed money and the journalism wasn't paying?
Yeah,
and
do you know the story?
No, I don't.
All right.
I'm gonna hear it right now.
By God, you're gonna hear it from the kid, as I was affectionately known as, you know, kid. What he was very proud of, and we're going to bring up a man that had come into Tulsa, and he was promoting, he was from Canada. His name was Sam Avey. Well, Sam had come in from Canada, and he was investing in Tulsa. He not only started a bank, but he also, he started theater. He brought just my fans.
They're barking at Jerry.
Short man syndrome. I got a corgi. I, you know, they don't realize, hey, that's enough. Yeah.
All right.
So anyway, yeah, they roll their eyes like, oh, yeah. I live with them. They don't live with me. So I live with them. Anyway, Sam had invested. He started theater and just a lot of other things. But the one thing that he did notice is he hadn't noticed my father's wrestling career. So he, along with this other ideas of the things that he was doing, and investing was promotion. He was a promoter of all sorts, but he took an interest in my dad's career and had followed where my dad, after my dad graduated, he immediately went to work for Tulsa World, which he's also involved, which was a newspaper, still is, I believe, of ours. We had Tulsa World and Tribune, and now we just have one barely in print. But he went right into the journalism background, but he loved sports. So he was at the sports desk. So he was an assistant, and that was his love. And that's where he was when Sam Avey approached him. And he said, well, tell me what are you making? He told him of his idea and that he had watched his career and obviously the coach that he had. And so my dad told him, he says, well, I'm making $25 a month. Okay. This is so 1930, this would be about 33, 34. And, Sam said, well, how would you like to make $25 a week? boom, he's gone. And that was what, that's what elevated him to leave, because he was already married, which I didn't, you know, those things come. He had been married probably about 2 years. He hadn't, there wasn't a child on the way, but he was married. So again, he had to make a living, and this is why he put himself through college. And you know, even with his fraternity, he just made his own way, and one eye didn't stop him. And so I you know, the things that have always got to me, if he always told me to diversify, to be able to do other things, be able to, you know, not be stuck in one position, be able to move on from that, because things happen, life happens. And apparently, you know, everything that he did, he had a steel trap of a mind that of perseverance and determined. He was determined to excel at anything that he did. So he did this, and it was also going to take him traveling, which obviously we all know. It wreaks havoc on a marriage, and especially something that is so new. And those days, you didn't fly. You know, those were tough old dirt roads. He would tell me, you know, he was a bad guy in Texas, John. They did not like my father in Texas. I had some, back when I was announcing, there would be people that would come up, you know, old timers, and they'd go, McGurk, would you happen to be related to dirty old, he called me dirty, dirty old McGurk? And I would like, yes, yeah. And I knew he was talking about, because my dad had told me about the stories. And, or St. Louis, you know, he wasn't, but he, you know, he was a heel in Texas, a bad guy, or I could say, but that's how it started, was how his wrestling career progressed. And it took him out to California. And, you know, he was out there when they were worried that the Japs were going to, the Japanese, I got to be careful. I don't want to by any way short sight or say anything bad, but the Japanese at the time, they were worried about them bombing California. So that was the only thing that probably left my dad leaving California. I've got pictures of him on the set with various movie stars. He's got a headlock on Jack Benny. This is kind of cool. He was a pretty good looking guy
too. We're getting history right here, Don.
Yes, we are.
Look at here. I don't know can you see that?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just one of them. And I think you can see it pretty good. Yeah.
What year was that again? Like 33, 34, somewhere in there?
Oh, this would be probably about 37. Yeah. Wow. I think it's 37. So yeah, that's pretty cool. And I've got, he's on the set here with Gene Autry, which he, you know, Gene was a friend of his. Even later on in the years, when Gene would come to Tulsa, he would always give Dad a call. And they used to have these Jubilee Diamond dinners. And my dad and mom went to see Gene. So, you know, again, I had no idea. Gene Autry, okay, some old cowboy, you know. God, I could kick.
Well, Gene Autry was from Oklahoma, right down the road.
Yeah, yeah, like around Sepulpa. Yeah, he was.
Yeah, they're Gene Autry, Oklahoma now, I believe, isn't it?
I believe so, yeah, yeah. But you know, and I keep on saying, and I don't know if people can call in, but anyway, Coach Gallagher was who my dad trained under. And I have a picture also of him in the ring, my dad's first title match. And Coach Gallagher's there in the ring, because, you know, my dad didn't have a relationship with his father. He drifted on, and it was basically my mom, my grandmother, my dad's mom, that raised three girls and one boy. And so that was where my dad came in. So, yeah, he had to be tough. He had two older sisters. And wow. And basically,
John and I both know that feeling.
You know that feeling? Yes, you do. Yeah. Yes, you do. But I didn't mean to take up the hour, but I get kind of wound up and excited about not only to see. But so back in the day, like what we have evolved into now, is superstardom. And that's what they were. You know, you didn't go to a wrestling match unless you were dressed. and you were somebody. And, you know, because people didn't have money back then. They were still coming out of 29. And, you know, it was, you know, and of course he was chided a lot, kidded. He was an Okie, you know, and the Okie term comes from us leaving Oklahoma and headed towards the promised land in California. But
yeah, in California, California just had all the influx of the Okies from the Dust Bowl and everything. So
yeah,
but that's amazing how your dad in that era and that time when transportation was basically getting on a train and taking 3 or 4 days to get to your destination. But your dad was a huge star in California and Oklahoma and Missouri and all those Midwest towns. But he had to make all those trips by train or bus. I mean, that had to be, you know, like an injury, like you say, it takes a toll on your family life, too, because you talk about, you know, we all bitch about us spending time on the road. We got to make a 2-hour road trip. Well, hell, they were making 4-day road trips on a damn train back in those days.
Well, you know, that dust storm was caused by Texas. So anyway,
I knew it would start. I knew it would start. I get on here with two Okies and I knew it would start. I need Hanson back is what I need.
Well, all those blowhards down there in the South, you know, they just started blowing all that dust from Texas came up to Oklahoma there. But we'll forgive them for that. But your dad was not only so, let's move forward a little bit. So him and Sam became friends at the Tulsa World there as journalists. So Sam was in the promotion. So your dad at that time was a wrestler. I read where Sam wanted to go back into the banking business and he had the promotion there, but he was not only promoting wrestling. He was promoting everything, which your dad did everything. Also, from Hollywood shows to musicals to everything. So Sam stepped aside, yeah. And then Leroy just came in, right?
Well, I think, too, because of the accident, you know, here my dad is, and he told me, he said, when that happened.
The first accident or the second accident where he lost?
This is the second. It was right. He had just finished the championship match. Okay. He was in
Little Bob Rock. Is that correct? Bob Clay was driving him to a restaurant or somewhere, a hotel or somewhere.
They had just left the restaurant. So after hours, and they had to go to Conway, Arkansas, because a lot of these little towns in Arkansas, as you know, are dry counties. So, and after hours, so they had gone to a place after hours and they were leaving and we're talking again. You don't have 4-lane highways. You've got 2-lane. And the headlights ran smack dab into the car that my dad was riding in. And he said he can remember that he pulling the glass out because he always wore his sunglasses to protect that, you know, his other eye. But he remembers it went through his only good eye, that the glasses never even broke on his bad eye. And he said, I can remember pulling the glass out. But he said that it was like a curtain closing over a period of about a year time. So he knew it wasn't good, but, and they just didn't have the technology. I have a article where he and his wife at that time were boarding an airplane. And I just found this stuff. It's fascinating where he was going to Johns Hopkins Hospital to try to save his sight. And so that was, you know, you just hit that and God, I'm not even born then, but can you imagine the hope that he had and the fear and, you know, my career, because he, like I said, he was right in the middle of his career and doing very well. And you have a whole year of, and he said he could stand back at his back window. And he said, kid, it's like a curtain closing. And he said, it was like that for his life. He thought, my God, my life is closing in on me. And Sam, being the promoter that he was and starting a bank, F&M, it was Farmers and Merchants. And like I said, he even had bought a building that burned around the time. I think my dad could still see, I'm not sure, but it was called the Coliseum. And I'm sure you probably heard about it. But they had circuses. They had anything that came into town. Sam Avey owned this building and that was the venue. So, because we didn't have these we didn't have these buildings back then. So I think a lot of it, because Sam you know, Dad had a little bit of Memphis with a guy named, oh my gosh, Les Wolf. And of course, Nick Gulas comes in there somewhere. But he let go of Memphis. But I do know that before I was born, that because he used to talk about the Elvis Presley story. And I'm like, oh, my God, because I love Elvis. I named my daughter Priscilla. Does that tell you something? But he used to tell me, he said that he would, that Elvis would come to the matches because they were, his parents were huge wrestling fans. And his uncle, Vester, was a very good friend of Sputnik and Sputnik and Rowe. So he would come with a guitar and want to sing during the break. And my dad's, he goes, oh, I'd tell him, go away, boy, go away. And I'd be like, oh my God, you didn't. Oh my God, you didn't. And I said, tell me you just let him play a couple of times, you know? And he goes, oh, maybe a couple of times. He goes, but I didn't see, you know, he goes, obviously, you know, but he knew of Colonel Parker because Colonel Parker was an old drift around kind of, he was a carny. He was a promoter and, you know, he used to handle Minnie Pearl and everybody knew if you were, you know, in the wrestling business or in that kind of profession that he was, he had been in the wrestling business too. Colonel Parker was somebody that, you know, was got lucky. He got lucky. And
got the right talent.
You bet. Thanks, Dad. But anyway, I can remember the day that Elvis died. We were down there at the wrestling office boo-hooing and crying. And Dad was like, oh, God, I know, I can't believe it. But it was thanks to my dad that I was able to go and see Elvis all the many times. And my mom, turned me on to him. It began with Viva Las Vegas, and I was hooked. Still am. I've got Sirius Radio is only on Elvis Radio. Done.
You know that Jerry the King Lawler almost had a wrestling match with Elvis. In fact, before Elvis died, they were working on it. They were going to have it. It was going to be judo versus wrestler, and it was going to be the king versus the king. And it was going to be Jerry Lawler versus Elvis. They had worked it all out. He worked it all out with his dad, and then Elvis goes off to Vegas. And, you know, part of the story, you know, part of what they were going to work toward, and then Elvis passed away unexpectedly. But Elvis would have been in the wrestling ring with Jerry Lawler. And of course, Lawler probably would have put himself over.
Of course.
I love it. I'm just kidding.
No, but we can kid all we want, but we know.
We know the king. We know that.
I know.
Before, you know, you talk about it, it was right in the middle of his career. It wasn't just right in the middle of his career. He was champion. He was recognized as the longest male champion, I guess, in wrestling history, certainly NWA history. He held it 10 years, 7 months, and 19 days from 1939
to
1950. And he didn't lose it. He had to abdicate it because of the injury. I mean, he was an incredible, one of the greatest champions of all time.
Well, let me tell you this, and Jerry and JBL, I even heard it from Lou Fez of what my dad was like in the ring. And it was down in Houston. And I mean, my dad said, hey, and Lou said it, he said, your dad straightened me right out in the middle of the ring. He was like, he tried that one more time again. And he said, you won't be walking out of here. And he knew it. I mean, my dad, the agility that he had, you know, he could move around more than like the heavyweight, but he it was all about leverage. And he would always tell me that. And years later, and you know that, Jerry, I would see my father out in the ring working out with the guys. You know,
well, I broke in in the late 60s, and Jack broke in 1965. And I remember going over to Tulsa with Jack. And at the time, he had the office at the Canes Ballroom, where all the country and western stars play. And they had a ring set up in there during the weekend. They had taken down on the weekend so the country music fans could all come in and do their party in there. But I remember when Jack was breaking in and Leroy couldn't control himself, but here's another national champion that he recruited. I mean, Leroy was known. I mean, little known fact, Leroy, Dick Hutton, one of the greatest NWA heavyweight champions. It was a 3-time NCAA champion at Oklahoma State. Leroy broke him into the business, and Dick is the one that went around, John, with a $100 bill glued to a tape to his chest. Anybody can beat me, hey, gets this. You know, of course, that $100 bill never left his chest there. But Leroy was standing at the step there just dying to get into the ring with Jack because, you know, he had recruited another national champion. Sure. And so And I go up and I put my arm around Leroy, but I could just feel those muscles, even at an advanced age, as your dad was at that time. He was a heck of a man and a heck of a promoter. And John, this is a guy, and it's no, I mean, you hear this story and you got, how in the hell does this happen? And Mike can probably back this up. Leroy was totally blind, sitting at a commentator's desk in at Oklahoma City TV, WKY Channel 4. Danny Williams was his broadcast partner. And Leroy as a color analyst, and Leroy could tell you what bump the guys were taking just from the sound of the ring. True or not, Mike?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And people just don't. And I said he was a color commentator, which always you fill in, you know, how do you fill in if you're not absolutely looking at that? And he was, he knew, he loved the business. And even to go on later, the love of the boys. You know that, and I know there's been some things said, and you know the good things are what I focus on. Of we all make mistakes, we all do this. We in the career, and some stories, like I've said a lot of times, I'm glad they can sell books, and I'm glad that they can elaborate on the truth. I'm still not tarnished because I know the truth, and I love my dad. It doesn't change anything. And if anybody ever wanted to know the truth. I had no idea of the fortitude that he taught me that's inbred. And I think that was kind of hard on me because, and it's not about me, but I mean, to be in the shadow of somebody that overcame so much and was good at everything that he did. And, how do you compare or how do you rise to, get a little bit of respect from him. And that's the reason why. And I love the business. You know, it took me a little bit, you know, high school, because I defended this thing from the time I was a little girl. Not only is my name Mike, but, you know, and your dad's a wrestling promoter and we all know it's fake. And, you know, that's the school I went to. It was Edison. And so I went to school with, you know, kids that were from attorneys and doctors. And I was, you know, I was the freak show. I was the circus. It is not. And you'd go into the room and you'd say it's fake. So it makes you a little tough. Not only that, I didn't go by Mike all the time because my middle name's Kathleen. It's Michael Kathleen. And I probably disappointed my dad a little bit, but he took care of that because anytime that any of those friends of mine come over to the house, it'd be, hey, Mike, do this, do that. And they'd go, Kathleen, why are you calling you Mike? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. But I embraced my name as I got older, is because that is my name. And I know why is he couldn't look out for me the way that he wanted to. And given me the name, and I think alcohol might've had a little bit to do with it because I have another article. I was supposed to have been born March 17th. St. Patty's Day, full bore, you know, Irish, but the doctor had to go somewhere. He had to go on a trip, so he called my mom, and he's like, hey, we're taking the baby. So my mom goes in the 16th of March, and I think around 2 a.m., here I'm on the scene. Daddy doesn't come home for 3 days. He's on the road, okay? All right, the thing of, and I have a newspaper article that says third day, McGirt baby still unnamed. So I was supposed to be Timothy Michael. And Pat was, you know, they were going to do something. Sam Abey had a daughter that was named Pat. So they thought about Pat and said, no, that's not going to work. And Dad's middle name is Michael. But when he was out in California, he met and was friends with the Barrymores. The John Barrymore and Ethel Barrymore. Well, they had a daughter. There was a sister that was named Michael. And my dad held on to that. And then he said, I got it's Michael. And my mom got Kathleen. So, but the other thing of it, whenever I was in trouble, it was Michael Jane. And I'm like, why? Where did Jane come in at it? Like, well, it's too, when they're mad at me, they couldn't go Michael Kathleen. They go, Michael Jane, get over there. So I was like, I never knew who I was.
Was your dad?
Mike was, I absolutely, you know, I feel for him so many times where, you know, he would ask the guys, excuse me, he would say, the guys tell me that you're a tall girl. The guys tell me that you're pretty stout. And I, you know, and he'd say, come here. And that was what he did with all the wrestlers. You know, he used to get Dick Murdoch and he'd go, good God, skinny legged, big belly. Like, Murdoch, you're not an athlete. You know,
it was always this one, Leroy, is around you on your body. From your shoulders, your neck, your ear, down to your fingers. He was always squeezing to find out, you know, if you'd been working out and feel your body tone and fit, just try to visualize what you look like. And
right,
he had good sense of feel, didn't he, Mike?
Black Bart used to say, Dick Murdoch, you look like an upside down light bulb.
I know.
Big head, that big belly, little bit skinny arms. Tough as he could be, though, but Dick had a terrible body.
Oh, he did, and was tough, and a great worker, you know, and so good to my dad. He told him not only is he not a wrestler, but he can't pick out good horses. My dad, he gave dad a horse that, oh my God. Yeah,
so Mike, we went through Dick Hutton, who was a huge star, who ended up NWA champion. But your dad wasn't finished there recruiting guy. Then along comes the Oklahoma hero, the Oklahoma, probably the greatest athlete ever come out of Oklahoma, the great legendary Danny Hodge out of another small town, Perry, Oklahoma. Well, where were you at that time of Danny and his accomplishments and what was going on?
Well, I wasn't old enough to really know. I just knew later on that he was kind of bumping around in Kansas and, you know, he was Golden Gloves. I think he was doing, some boxing.
Right.
And I don't know how the meeting, but I think Red Berry, Wild Red Berry.
Wild Red Berry. Do,
you bet. With the two of them getting together. And, Danny was such a soft-spoken, you know, he was very soft-spoken, but, you know, he could come right up to you and whisper to you and say, I can tell you, if you don't do this, I will tear your shoulder off. And and he could, you know, there was no doubt that, and my dad, I never saw a man cry like that man did when my dad passed away. I mean, he was inconsolable, totally. But, and my dad, you know, I don't think that he ever realized the love that Danny had for him. But there was, you know, and that's the thing that I can get into Jack knew it. Danny came and then there was Jack. And it just almost seemed, because Jack, you know, your brother, what a star, what an athlete, what a guy, you guys, both of you. And then, you know, I remember you coming along. Mm-hmm. I remember going with Karen looking for places to live because Jack had these kids and Karen and we were looking for a place for Jack to, you know, home in Tulsa. Yeah. And yeah, kid went everywhere, but Jack, you know, had it not been for Danny and the time, there'd been more room for Jack, I'm sure. And you know, when you all went down to Florida and, you know, my dad went down there, there was a title match and we went down there and, of course, everybody got along, you know, the promoters got along, Don Owens, and, you know, you had Fritz, and it was a family. NWA was a united and Senior. Heck, I knew Senior before I knew of Vinny, you know, I knew of because my dad and he served on the grievance committee of the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance. And I remember asking Senior, and I say Senior for those out there that's listening, is Vince McMahon Senior, Vince's daddy. What a prince of a guy, super, and dressed all, he was GQ all the way. I'm like, oh my God. And so well-mannered. And I remember asking it, just being polite and not knowing. This was probably, 79, 80-ish like that. And I said, so you have a son, is he in wrestling? And he goes, oh, Vinny. He's in television. Boy, is he in television. Did we learn that much? But so I just got glimpses of some really, great people. of this business and what the Jim Barnett, I mean, for whatever Jimsy was about, you know, he's from Oklahoma. Did you know
that?
Yeah,
he's an Oklahoma City guy.
His family got rid of him, you know, for the reasons that, you know, personal reasons or whatever. We, you know, some of us know why, but he, it was Barnett Oil. They were, you know, well-to-do. And I would have never had the experience or been able to embrace you guys if it hadn't been for the man that we're talking about. And I get really worked up about it because I love my father. And I got his pictures everywhere, and you know, because he lives, you know, when things get tough, or you know, heck, when I went up there with Vince, that was the deal. He's like, we're a small group here. It's my mom, my dad, and me, and I, then I had my two kids, and Vince is like, bring them on. He's a load up the truck. And I said, you load up the truck. We're moving to Beverly. Because we were, you know, at that time, that's why I can't say good enough about Vince. You know, there's always people that have their things with Vince McMahon, but Vince, he knew my story. He knew of my father. He knew the love that I had for this business, and that obviously a marriage to a wrestler didn't work out. But I wanted to be a part of it. And my dad, you know, from the time I was a little girl, the wrestling fans would come up and say, "Is that the next ladies wrestling champion?" But Daddy always wore these dark sunglasses, as you know. And when he was, you know, when you hit a nerve, that eyebrow went up above that eye, you know, those glasses are like, oh shit.
It was the Rock's eyebrow before the Rock come along.
Oh yeah. It was like, oh God. Oh man. You know? So no, that was never to happen. And so how all that happened, everything was based upon, on a great, great man and how he recognized the talent, you know, and what he did with Danny. And there were some times with Danny, you know, like he said, it's like, you know, he, and taking nothing away from Danny, but like he said, and he went to OU. That he would bring Danny. We would go over to the OU and OU and OSU were wrestling, and you know, and we'd be going at it. Danny would go over there and coach the OU wrestlers, and my dad would be going, "God damn, I bring you over here as a guest, and you go over there and you're coaching against my team." Yeah, and he's like, "You know, that's the only reason you went to OU is they made a class for you in upholstery." So it's like, oh God, he said, you couldn't have passed anything else, but he, you know, and Danny was so good about it, but he wasn't the smartest, you know, knife in the drawer, but he didn't have to be. He was, you know, he didn't have to be.
Yeah. You know, your dad was coached by the guy that turned Danny Hodge down for a scholarship though. I mean,
yeah.
By Mr. Gallagher, Coach Gallagher there. I mean, Danny really wanted to be a cowboy with all of his heart. And he was so upset that he had already been to on an Olympic team. But what Coach told him, I already got a guy at your weight. I would never tell somebody that, because the very next year, Hodge pinned that guy in 16 seconds. And Gallagher hauled him
home. Right. But I think,
Mike,
Gallagher looked at the fortitude. I don't know if he didn't see in Danny that, you know, hey, we make a little mistake. He passed on him. And, oh, you got him, but that's okay.
Mike, you mentioned the fact that how your dad recognized talent, but he was from that 1950 on, he was blind. How did that happen? I mean, it just boggles the mind that somebody could be blind and he's still a wrestling promoter, which is so visual. I know what you're talking about, but it seems, was somebody there that helped him, see things? How did that work? That, 'cause this is an amazing story.
Well, you know, I sidetrack, but I also make it fun for all of us too. There was my mom, and he always asked from different people, you know, their opinions. He always had, there was always guys around, not some of them, like Jack Gott was a trusted childhood friend. There was another
Leo Voss. Man, Leo Voss, I think was another one. You remember Leo Voss?
Leo Voss. Yeah, I mean, we're right on the same track.
And then and Mickey Martin, who was a three-time national champion at OU, and then his son went to OU and was a three-time national champion.
Yeah, there was Wayne Martin.
Those were Leroy at my time. Those were Leroy's close associates, and actually his eyeballs to talent, because those guys would be asking you questions all the time, getting information that they could feed back to Leroy.
Right. Right. And then, you know, to working out, what are you made of, you know, working out and getting in the ring. And but that's, you know, he loved the amateur. That's, and like you said, he goes professional kid. And he would say that he goes professional kid makes me a good living. But his love was amateur wrestling, you know, and even in the college sports, he was never, you know, the pro. He loved the kids, the athletes, the weren't paid, that had the heart, just like what, you know, he had. So a lot of it too, John, he had a good instinct, but he also, your background, what are you made of? Where did you come from? Because that's how he's building his story, where he came from, how his career was. You know, he wrestled in high school. And then, in, you know, because you don't be able to go different classes and train those days, like go up in class, go down in your weight class. And it's not wrestling. You know, my son did it. I started him at 5 years old. And both of the Steiner brothers told me when I was on the road, they were like, you're going to burn that boy out. And I'm like, oh, no. And he goes, in Oklahoma, you start him that early? I'm like, yeah. You know, I mean, absolutely. And so you have to have, not only you've got to know not only your endurance, your career, but how are you going to stay with it? Are you going to stay with the program? Are you a quitter? And that's what, another thing that Dad looked at is, you know, this isn't just we're going to do this and you get out. This is rough. This is a tough deal. And as you know, there's times I'm not in the ring, but I know that, you know, it become a shoot at any time, and you better be able to wrestle your way out of it. And can't think of the right word, but it is what he was looking for is commitment and persistence, dedication. But he had all those people that surrounded him, and a lot of people, you know, Bill, we'll mention him too. Some people came in and out of his life and promotion, but we'll get to him. But he relied on those guys to tell him, and also what he could, you know, is he going to make some money? Is he going to make himself some money? And family, you know, Dad took care of families. Look, I knew Teddy. When, you know, and I always told that my mom, when Ted first came in, you know, Ted was Rookie of the Year, DiBiase. But remember, Iron Mike was from Nebraska. And see, that was another thing. He was junior heavyweight champion. Irish Mike Clancy. You know, you had all these people that had schooling and amateur background and wrestling, because Dad wanted to incorporate that with the professional part of it. And because, remember, we're still, it might be showmanship, but it was real, and to a lot of people's eyes, you know that. And to me, it still is. I try not to read some of the comments that I do, and I'm like, God, what? And people get so bold behind the internet, and they talk about fake or injuries or anything. I have an injury. I've had two back surgeries. That wasn't, you know, I think that was another thing that Vince saw, and it was by accident. You know, I mean, I got hit, and that's, it wasn't intentional. I wasn't even in the ring. I was trying to get out of the ring, and Warrior accidentally, you know, he was another one that usually the guys had a set pattern. You know, you come in, you make your entrance, and by God, anytime I was there to enhance the talent. I was not the talent. I was there to enhance it and say, you know, women can do this and not have to sell sex or anything else. But I'm also got my foot in the door of being, you know, making my dad proud. You know, it's like, yeah, and I'm not giving anything away. I'm not having to be beat up and going through the things that you all did. But I still had a part of it. Well, what happened as I was trying to make the way to the chair and he came back, he doubled back on me. And within about 3 days, I didn't know why my back was hurting. And the doctor said, well, it was it herniated disc at that time. And it took a couple of days longer, and I coughed the wrong way. And I mean, just like a cough, and boy, I mean, it was like somebody had just jabbed me in the side of the left side. And so what that told me, the doctor told me, my disc blew. And when my disc blew, they explained to me, as you all know, it's like crab meat. And so when it blew, it wrapped itself around my left leg nerve ending. So I had drop foot immediately. I didn't know, everything was happening so fast, but I was seeing the nerves, like it was like an electric going off in my left leg. And I was like, God, you know, it wasn't moving, but it felt as if there was somebody shocking me. And that was the beginning of the drop foot. And oh my God, I was off 6 weeks. And I, again, my dad, you know, he was already passed by this time, but I thought, you know, I've got to come back. And I was worried about losing my place, thinking, you know, if I'm off TV. And so what they did to me is a lumbar laminectomy. And so we got that done. So when I hear that, it's like, God, and you guys, look at this. You know, I grew up with seeing Al Lovelock and the Bolos and the guy. Yeah. I remember I was
Sputnik.
I love Sputnik. Sputnik was the coolest thing around. He had, you know, he had that white streak in his hair, and he was colorful, and he was.
Did you tell us your favorite Sputnik Monroe story? We all have Sputnik Monroe stories, and he was probably one of my favorite characters. When I was a rookie, I had the privilege of him sitting shotgun in my car, and telling me I was so proud of my car because your dad had taken care of me, and I had saved enough money to buy my first, not new car, but used new car, you know, sure. My five-year-old car. And I was so proud of that car, so I had to take it on a trip. And Sputnik Monroe sitting there with his tobacco and his beer and all that, spitting all over the place. Kid, it's just transportation. I got so mad I wanted to fight Sputnik, you know, and he said, well, pull off. He said, how far you want to go? I said, well, I just want to go to Tulsa up here and get out, you know. And he was talking about how far you want to go fighting. You know, I don't know, man. I don't want to fight. I just want to go to Tulsa and get mad. You know? And yeah, what's your favorite Monroe story? He won a classic.
Oh, just a character in himself. You know, he picked up, I think it was Nancy's first wife and dad kids. But after that, he had a divorce and he picked up the stripper. I don't know if you remember Sherry at all.
Yeah. God.
Cross-eyed Sherry. She was cross-eyed.
Gotcha. We used to call her Gotcha. You remember Gotcha?
Yes. Yes. Oh, my God. And so I had heard that from my dad and said something anyways. Sputnik used to come back to my bedroom and visit because he'd say, man, you got the music going on and the black lights. And he said, kid, you know, he said, turn that music up. And I said something about it. I said, and I just, it slipped out of my mouth. But I said, so how's Gotchai? But I mean, that's shit. But that's what she was known at the bar, because Monday nights after wrestling, I'd go and just look at the guy, you know, and try to be, you know, there's no way that I could outdrink Murdoch or any of those guys. My God, God, there was somebody else. But they would gather up around there because they would close it up so you could, you know, you could have Carl Cox and all of them up there and it, just listen to the stories. But there was many stories, but the one of them is that, you know, about how he straightened her eyes out she was a pretty lady. And, you know, she was very well built. And I guess things kind of worked out. But he says, you know, I've got her all straightened out so she can look at my mom with one eye. I was like, oh, God, it's just, he would tell me.
But then she left him, right?
Huh?
But then she left him, right?
Yeah.
So Akbar told me the story. Akbar, this is one of his favorite stories. He said he fixed the Gotchai, and one day she wakes up and says, look at me and look at you. I deserve better.
Yeah.
And she left him.
And I'm not taking care of your mother anymore. I'm out of here. Oh yeah, straightened her eyes out. Beautiful. Yeah, I mean, but it was hard. You know, I was like, he's, you know, she always sees me as two people. And I'm like, oh God, one of you is enough, you know, in those spots. But he was such a colorful guy and character. And of course, you know, he always gave me the stories that he got, went up to, and I think he did. Jerry, he went up and saw Elvis because he was personal friends with Vester. When Elvis died, Daddy wouldn't let me go. I think I'm 20, but Daddy wouldn't let me go to Memphis because he said that you don't need to be around there. Just like when I wanted to go to California and I want to be an actress, he goes, no, he called Gene Autry and Gene Autry snuffed that deal. So great. So 2 weeks later, I went there and Elvis was still at the mausoleum, but I went there to the gate and Vester was there. And I must have stayed there, honest to God, I was there probably 4 hours to 6 o'clock in the morning talking wrestling stories, Elvis stories, and commingling with the Oklahoma territory and the Nick Gulas, and because he was a wrestling fan, and then Tretch Phillips, you know, that came into it, and crying, you know, here I am, and like, oh my God, all my friends are coming by, and they're like, Mike, are you ready? Like, no. to go back, I jump forward and I go back, and I'm sorry because we could probably go this 2 hours, 3 hours because of the stories. But how my dad knew, it is incredible how he knew the talent, but he depended on other people. But he also just like, you know, to fill in that color and to be able to know that match. And nobody was telling him that. Jerry knows that. And it wasn't something that say, hey, Leroy, this is what's going to happen. You couldn't do that. He's blind. And he, you know, we always say my mom was his leader dog, his seeing eye dog, but you know, she was, mom took some abuse, didn't she, Jerry? But
yeah, she
was
did.
In for the long haul.
Dorothy, God damn it, bring my whiskey over here.
Yeah. And, you know, hey, the only time that one of the boys told me, and it was one night at the show, and they said, you know, when you had a snort, those days is what I remember what a snort's about. And that's what they meant. It was old Duggan. It was Hacksaw Jim Duggan. And I told him about it when I saw him at WrestleMania. I was like telling the girls, I said, I love your dad and I love Deborah. And I said, you know, he's the only one that ever said, hey, kid, come on over here. You know, you're Leroy's daughter. You could use a good snort before you go out to the ring. And, you know, that was just a little hit. You know, he had a little shot of whiskey. And that was my dad, you know, and he had it, that chaser, because it wasn't, you know, he had a half pint and a chaser. Of course, it was always in a brown paper sack, you know.
He loved those half pints. That's what you had to bring all the time, with a half pint.
Yeah. And a lot of, you know, where people say, oh, well, he drank every day. And you know, back in those days, it wasn't where he was drinking while there was work. After work, when you have gone through all of this and, you know, the guys can't make it, or a guy got hurt, God knows, in promotion or the television. And that was another thing. Do you know that, and I was told this, that, and Danny Williams would tell you, the television, on the onset of television, they were approaching my father for the content to put wrestling on. That was when they were saying, hey, we'll sell the advertising, everything. We want your program. And that's how that started in Oklahoma City, is how we got television. They came to us. Same thing in Tulsa. And funny how the evolution went to where it became, we were, you know, where we were paying them.
Well, that was the deal back there. The promoters had to pay to be on TV, but Oklahoma, like you said, your dad was such a state hero and, you know, so well known locally and so respected that the TV people, I was told that from there, that Leroy never paid for TV there.
No.
That's amazing.
No. And, you know, those 44 minutes it was left for them to, and they made money. They, you know, at one time we were on primetime. We were on Saturday. We went to Saturday afternoon, but we were Friday night, you know, Oklahoma City. And then also to remember the territories, from what I understand and what I've always known, even through my dad, was as far as your television could reach. Huh. That was your territory.
Right.
So just remember, we had all of Oklahoma. We had southwest part of Missouri, all of Arkansas. Then they went into Louisiana, because Louisiana was, you know, it was untouched. You had
the first place they sent me, Mike, was Louisiana.
That's where they break you in and see, you know, how big a boy are you? Because those road trips are, you know, when I had Pat Patterson tell me, Pat Patterson sat there and he goes, McGurk. And he said, I ought to tell you some stories about your dad. Because he told me how rough it was back in the 50s. Gorilla monsoon. Same thing. You know, I'm like, great. My dad's got really paved the way for me here. They all had to tell me about the bat, you know, the road trips in Louisiana. And remember, again, now we're going back even farther. You know, you've got the 58, 55, 58, 59. And Louisiana still doesn't have the greatest roads. And they had horrible roads, you know, two lane and bayous. You know, Danny himself, you know, he had that accident. You know, he never drove by himself. And on that one occasion, then, you know, he did. And thank God that trucker saw him. You know, that happened. And had he not had the strength that he had, you know, he sunk. He went right off the road and went in and was sunken in that bayou. And had he not had the strength to bust the windshield out and to climb out of that, you know, it was what, like, wasn't it just a minuscule of within of an inch of it being completely broken?
Yeah, exactly. And Danny props his neck up with his hand and crawls out of that river and crawls up the riverbank and crawls about a half mile down the road before a trucker stops and picks him up.
Yes. Yep. And that was one
let's go to the big cowboy. When he entered the fray there, I think it was in the early 70s when he first come in there. I don't know how
involved
he was.
Right about 69. I can remember that. And and see, at that time, and I still have I have publicity shots of the big cowboy, and Dad sent him up there to our ranch. So the cowboys would get the calf.
The cowboy Bill Watts, for you that don't know.
Cowboy Bill Watts, yeah. Large William. So so they would set it all up for him. So then Bill would come in and then put his knee down like he had roped. You know, as this was all my dad's ideas, you know, setting the stage for Cowboy Bill Watts, because he was so big. And remember, that's why Dad couldn't. He said all he's good is for tagging in and tagging out, because his talent was junior heavyweight. So all he could do is go in there, bam, 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 and tag out. Because he didn't have the competition. So Dad sent him to New York, and he went up to New York, and that's when he, you know, from New York, I think he went, and then he went on to, he went to work for Vern, but he also stayed in touch with my dad. You know, I think there was a relationship, because there's so many times that I'd be, I'd come home or be woken up at night, and Bill and my dad were up talking business and what they were going to do, and, you know, or how Bill was selling it that he could do and take my dad's, take it a little bit farther and take it out of maybe the stagnant state, because we're going through Booker's, you know, Terry Garvin, the famous Garvin brothers. I remember the Bookers that we've had, and you know, it's a tough job, and you have to keep it flowing. You got to keep the talent flushed. You know, you can't, you got to send them on to somebody else and then bring somebody else in. That's again, like the Teddy story. My mom's story about that, she goes, oh, that damn little Ted DiBiase. He said, when he was a boy, him and his little brother came over here and tore up all your stuffed animals. I was like, oh, great. So, and you know, Helen Hild was a lady wrestler, and his mom, you know, Helen was a lady wrestler. Ted's real mom, his birth mom. So, and you know, just all those little stories that I still, razz him on as we were kids. But Bill, when he, the second time around, he came back in, and this is when he wanted a book. And then it became, so this would be, in the mid 70s. So he had gone back out, still come back in and discuss some things with my dad, and was trying to take the territory a little bit further and bigger. And at one time he had a great idea, and it would have worked had there not been, maybe I think Bill wanted so much control, and that's fine. But, you know, North Carolina was on fire, and they were developing their own stars. Well, and what Vern was doing, the same thing. Why don't we just close that Midwest up? So what we were doing is being hold on to our talent. And I say our, forgive me on that. I had nothing to do with it, the talent, to where we could use Joe Blanchard. We'd use Joe, we'd use Fritz, and then we'd have great relationships with Pat O'Connor and Bob Geigel in the Kansas City territory, and then we'd close it in with Vern, and we'd have the talent so that we weren't, the competition. We still didn't have the television that was going global yet. We still weren't in the 80s, remember, that's when things just busted wide open. And to combine the television, because again, I'll tell you, all of Arkansas and the bicycling of the tapes. We had a guy. Do you remember Oni Wiki Wiki? If somebody would look up, he was the first barefooted place kicker for the University of Hawaii. And Oni Wiki Wiki, his real name was Lamho, and Oni Wiki Wiki was quick, and that was his stage name. He wore the little Hawaiian deal and wrestled barefooted, and was at the junior heavyweight time. He was like mid card, but heck, he had a good run over there in Nashville. He did really good in Tennessee and went around. So, but Wiki was another office guy that came home and came back to Tulsa. And bicycled the tapes when we were bicycling these tapes to, Louisiana and Mississippi. And, Dad built a building in Jackson because we couldn't, the building that we were using, they didn't like what was going on. Because Jackson, not in Jackson, but it was Greenwood, Mississippi. He built the own building, bought the land, and Dad said, "The heck with it, I'll get my building." And they built it. And because Greenwood was tough. I mean, there's a couple of stabbings. Hodge got stabbed by his own dad. And that ended, JB, I want to bring you in on this, is that I know you're listening, is to keep the guys from wearing the same color of trunks. And remember, boys didn't tell the families of what was, of the business, did they, Jerry? I mean, no. And Danny's dad was not smart about it. And I don't know if it was Jack. Was he in there with Dandy Jack Donovan? It was somebody. And he just
Angelo Savoldi.
Savoldi. And he went in there and the dad just started slashing. And
I think the alcohol just had a lot to do more with it than colorblindness.
yeah. But, I was told the trunk stories, I was like, well, by God, not have that happen. So, and I appreciate you asking that about how did Dad form that? How did he do that? It's amazing to me how he had to have the mind to rely on a good booker of how to put these guys together. And incorporate what he knew of his years of being a champion and what it took and the psychology that it took and Bill sold him on the fact that, it's a different time and you got to grow with it, Leroy. And Dad trusted him. He wasn't a dummy. And in fact, I think so much so that the power, you get so much power I don't know, that was the sad thing that I felt that when it all came down to the end, that it wasn't such a partnership, and my dad was crushed by it. Literally when Brian Blair was there at the time, and we got a messenger that came to the door and said, "Your stuff will be packed up and put in storage. You're officially over. It's done." And my dad had just changed. He had just changed it because Daddy had always held on to 51% and Bill 49%. And he had decided, well, maybe this is a good time to maybe ease on out. And I trust you. And he just wanted Dad out of the way. And, he wanted me out of the way because at that time I was starting to figure things out. And, I think it became a little bit of my dad's eyes and probably shouldn't have said some of the things that I saw, but it wasn't right. And, Bill, and this is the truth, Bill Watts came to my apartment where I was living and offered me money. He said, "What's it going to take to buy you out of here?" He said, "I just want to ship you out of state." And, you realize that it's big business. And this is before that he had taken over on my dad, but I didn't know then, but I do now that, and that's why Vince knew of my story that, God, kid, you got caught up in the middle of this. And I was like, pretty much, but you know, it was also the love of my dad and things weren't going right. And, you'd hear one story and then, you know, it was being told totally different to my dad, and because he was kept in the dark. When it became, because my dad loved going to television, he loved being around it. It was his business, and
it was his life. It was his life too. I mean, it was his life. Years at that time, but that was his entire life. You know, from college on to that period of time. And
he was scared every day. Every day he was scared of the fact of not, you know, it was not being, you know, of losing a dollar. That's why nothing that he had was ever bought on credit. You know, if he couldn't build that building in Green, Mississippi, then it wasn't happening. His ranch, the same thing, you know, because he remembered those lean days of not having anything. And he goes, I remember when those banks yanked those homes out and you didn't have it anymore. And, you know, he was always afraid of not being able to make that buck in any way that he could, because of he never used that. He never, you know, he goes, I'm not a blind man. I just can't see. I'm not a blind man. And the only thing that he ever did in Braille was play cards. And he was really good at that. JBL, he had a poker face to die for. I mean, you never knew the hand that he was holding, but he had how he was so informed. And you know that his journalism came back into it. There was a thing that was called talking book. You remember that? That he would always sit in his chair, and it was the U.S. Library of Congress for the blind sent these to the blind. And this is, you know, before they had any of these programs going, but it was books and magazine articles and where you could keep up with the day of the times. But it was mostly books, and he read books, and I would wake up in the middle of it because it had that droll voice. Whoever was doing and reading these books, you know, it was just this real drawl, and I couldn't miss it. It'd wake you up. And Dad would wake you up, you know, he'd say, get up here, Dorth, come here, listen to this. And he'd run into something really good on a book. And it would just, you know, and he kept his mind fresh. He didn't want to be in a room that he couldn't be a part of the conversation. And he very, very, right.
Mike,
have I taken too much? It's like,
no, it's great stuff. But I want to ask you a question. I saw an interview you did with a mutual friend of ours, Sean Mooney, who I just love. What a wonderful guy. But you told a story about when your dad found out that you liked Ted DiBiase, that your dad broke Ted DiBiase's arm. And later he shot at Brian Blair, who you were married to. Did this kind of your dating life when they realized that your dad either might kill him or maim him?
Well, you know, I was his only daughter. I will say this: he had a daughter from a first marriage, but I was the kid. And again, I think a lot of it too. He never saw me, and he didn't want me to get in. You know, Jerry, do you remember a promoter named Morris Siegel? He was down there somewhere. Sorry. Okay. Well, right. I don't know. I guess he had a daughter that went with the wrestlers, and by God, that was not going to happen with his daughter. Okay. Well, you know, up until the Ted DiBiase era, you know, besides Jack and you guys, you were good looking, but I, you know, you older and I, but, you know, no. Well, Ted was kind of my age, and, you know, we just hit it off and started talking. Wrong to do, but not to get too close. But I think a lot of it was, and that was another thing with Bill. See, I was trying to gain a little bit of insight, and I was. Ted was telling me things that, you know, and another great friend of my dad's, and he was such a good wrestler, was TJ, you know, Tom Jones. And Tom, you know, before it was cool of working out, Tom Jones worked out. And what a body, you know, you talk about commitment. And he loved my dad. And that's why there was a couple of books, you know, said, and I think it might've been Bill's where he said something about the black issue. My dad loved the black wrestlers. He loved the black, he knew what it was like to be raised poor, white, black, whatever. He knew that. So, you know, the other part of it was we had race riots. My dad remembered that, you know, Tulsa's been getting a lot of bad rap, and, you know, it was called race riots, not massacre. Now it's called a massacre because for insurance reasons and I think for compensation. But my dad remembered those things. So he never would have been that kind of a guy, or he would say, well, is he a black guy? But anyway, I didn't see a black man, but I saw a wrestler. And I think with Ted, the thing that happened, because he knew of Ted's daddy that had passed, obviously. And I thought that would help. But the fact that he knew that life and didn't want that for me, don't know why, but maybe because of the heartache. And it's tough to be a wrestler's wife. Bottom line, it's tough to be a wrestler's wife. And me knowing what that wrestler's wife goes through, he was like, me being jealous didn't help anything, you know, because I knew what was going on. But Ted and I met, we had a great time. It got out to Bill Watts, and when Bill painted it a different picture, and honest to God, Bill was instrumental in busting us up. He brought, Ted was going through a divorce, and he brought Ted's ex. A lot of this isn't brought up. Nobody knows a lot of this. This is first, you guys. Ted had his wife, his ex, soon to be ex-wife, probably like within 3 months, Jeanette out of Amarillo. Bill brought her to a television, brought her to Shreveport, and they got together, and that was it. It was done. He said, you need to get back with your wife. I'm going to take care of this end. And so I get upset. I'm devastated. I had just taken Ted DiBiase, July 4th, 1976, Tulsa, Oklahoma, to the Oral Roberts Auditorium, Oral Roberts University. We saw Elvis, and he still talks to me about that day. And he goes, you're the only one that took me to Elvis. And I go, yeah, how funny is that? Because I had met Elvis's stepbrothers in Las Vegas during a wrestling thing. And we had just vicariously ran into each other. And of course, I was a fan. Anyway, I said, come on, Ted, let's go back. I said, we might not get to meet Elvis, but I said, I want you to meet the stepbrothers. I'm not going back there to stay. Man, that ego and that pride, he would not go. So that next day, I took Ted and dropped him off the airport and never saw him again. And I said, isn't this funny? And I told him that. I said, not only did I put your ass on a plane, I'm looking over there at the Lisa Marie. And it's like, I didn't get to see Elvis. And I lost my boyfriend over here. And I'm like, something's wrong with this picture. But I think a lot of it was Dad was going to go down there. And he was at television. And he broke my heart. And I was pretty devastated. And I think my dad was not aware of Bill's involvement. So he just thought that Ted had dumped me. So that was why he was going to go down there, and he was going to use the, I don't know that he was.
Was he going to shoot Ted? I always heard he had a gun, and he always had a gun.
Oh, he had a gun. He always had a gun.
Shoot Teddy.
Yeah. He was, I don't know that he would have, now, Jim,
well, that's a great story anyway.
Yeah. This is where you sell books. Okay. This is where you sell books. I know that he was devastated. My dad was devastated for me. And he's like, I told you not to get wrapped up in this. And I just, you know, Ted was different, but also Ted was also, he was my connection to what later, which I wanted Brian to do, and Brian, bless his heart, he was too young. I can't be in that back. I can't be that boy that my dad needed. I can't be that connection with the wrestlers to make this thing, you know, to keep this business going. And that's why I said, my God, if we had not had Skandor, we had Art Nelson here for a little while. And of course, Art Nelson was way, he went back to the 50s. And boy, you talk about, you don't sit in a hold for 30
minutes.
That
was a way back machine there.
Oh my God. And so we had to get, we had to flush him out. And we had some good people in here. You know, we had George Scott. George came in here, but, you know, George needed to spend a lot of money. And we didn't have a lot of money to go fight because Bill was coming at and television. You know, we were fighting. New York was coming in. TBS was all over the place. And we had just get this, JBL. We were just on the edge of getting our first U channel. thank goodness, because when Bill took over our contract, he went over to NBC, our Channel 2 network, our local NBC network. The only place we could go was you. Well, in that day, a lot of people didn't have that antenna. I know we were talking, oh gosh, you new people that have all this stuff and you know, the iPhones and everything, you have no idea. Oh my God, let's get a coat hanger and we'll bring in the U channel 23. But that's how we ended up, was getting on that channel to survive. And Mike, you can't survive.
Mike, I got a couple of weeks ago, we had the great James Beard on our show, Briscoe, Sword of Briscoe, and that's Bradshaw over there, by the way. But we had James Beard on there, and we were talking about a great friend of all of us, Skandor Akbar. And you sent me a little tweet, said, if it hadn't been for Skandor, we probably wouldn't have had a territory for the last 2 years. Explain to us what you meant by that.
Everything. Jim held my dad together. He also got a hold of, you know, we had the Kozaks, we had a little bit of Amarillo, we could bring the Romeros in. We needed talent. And we needed a booker. We needed somebody that could get along with the boys, had a good mind, could take care of my dad. And because dad wanted to know everything about his business, you know, keep him informed. And we didn't know at the time where the drinking probably, you know, we thought, now we know why he was drinking, because he was Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's was so new at the time that when he got it, that they took a picture of his brain in January and then took a picture of his brain in May and then went, oh my gosh, and this was a new disease in 88. So we go back and we're thinking, well, maybe, daddy don't drink as much. And we would keep the booze away from him. But his mind still was not there. Skandor did. He wore so many hats, Jerry and JBL. He got us a talent. He kept the talent. We had good matches. He not only worked and was on the road, he would be right back at that office at 9 o'clock that morning. It was tough. And he was not at home. You know, he was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, he had a couple of nice big girlfriends that took care of him, because he wasn't staying at a hotel. I mean, these gals were great. They were the ones that would always come into ringside dressed really well. But, you know, they had the false eyelashes and they had the cigarette holders. And they were the only ones that I ever knew that would come in with mink furs or anything. I mean, just over the top. Those were Scans ladies. Yeah. And they'd pick him up. And, you know, like he said, he goes, hey, I'm staying at her house. And he goes, I don't have to worry about a thing. And they didn't. They fed him. They cooked for him. You know, what did he need? He just sent the money home. But what we needed was Scans and his unwavering friendship towards my father and my mother, and how he knew how important it was for my dad to have this business. And my mom would go cash a CD for us to keep, you know, to stay in. And Scan would take me on, you know, he would help me. He'd say, come on, kid, ride with me. He had Mr. Pogo with him and just some really characters, but I would love to listen to Scan on the road. And he was so respectful and just a good, good guy. But I knew him as a kid too, because, you know, he was, you know, had the Danny Hodge thing, you know, so he was not always with the turban, you know, he was a good guy. And he really was soft-spoken. And had that forehead, you know, he would move that forehead, but you talk about, it didn't matter anytime how he loved and thought of my father. And that said it, and it proved, you know, he wasn't making a lot of money doing what he was doing, but he repaid this family tenfold, because we would have, like I said, we would have not been able to have the doors open as long as we did had not been for Scan. And because of his connection and how he was so good with the talent. And you've got to have that, because, you know, when you're working with talent, there's personalities in there, you know, and everybody deserves, wants that break, and that it shouldn't go that way. And, you know, you that was where Brian had the problem, is you can't be one of the boys and really be the booker. You've got to take a lot of hits. It's not a thankful job, and it comes down to business. You know, I learned what a pencil meant, and because I know, like they said, you know, if you don't do or do this, you're erased. And a million times I would see somebody on top that would be erased or something. Like, oh my God, that's how easy you could be replaced. So yeah, and you know, going back to Stan Hansen and Frank, he was Frank Goodish, you know, he became later, you know, but those two came in. And what I remember, that was the fun time I had talking to Stan. Wasn't one of them a school teacher? Wasn't one of them in education some way? But those two came in together.
Frank was a journalist. So he studied journalism at college. That's right. And that's how he started out, was through journalism. So he had a contact with your dad through journalism, probably.
That's what Barbara said, that, you know, Frank adored my dad. And I think, you know, that was another thing, JBL, when you get into like how my dad wanted to know your background. Did you have just more to it than wrestling? What else is to your life? And that broadened the sense of who you were about as a human being to him, because we are more than we're a family man. We're a dad. We're this. But we, you know, wrestling is our core. But that we also think outside the box. So, I remember those two guys coming in, and there you are. And there you've got your heavyweights, and they came in, and because this was where a lot of times they came into the Oklahoma, Louisiana territory, broke in, and then away they go. Because we had the smaller guys. You remember Argentina Zuma?
Oh, yeah.
You know, we had Pat Barrett, you know, Nelson Royal. You know, we have some,
all great performers too.
These are just names that I read, Jerry. You know, I don't know. I know too much, and I say too much, and it's like, gosh, have you been around that long? You know, I have. Yeah, you know, I have just a bit, but I enjoy it talking. You know,
so Mike, okay, the end has come now, and Vince is coming in now. You guys were of the territory, like most of the territories back in those days, where you bicycled tapes, so you really had no library, no inventory of tapes, right? And you kind of missed out on that, because the system of those days, those big 2-inch tapes, they cost so damn much money that you had to tape over them every week. So much great footage was lost to economics during that time there. But How did you finally make that move? You mentioned, you touched on it a little bit before, where Vince knew your plight, knew your background. But how was that contact made, and how did you end up becoming the first lady announcer for WWF at the time?
Who'd ever thought that? Well, I'll tell you. The connections of John Ringley. Does that name strike a bell?
John Ringley, yeah, he was in Carolina. He's the one that basically built George Scott's reputation there in Carolina.
Right. Well, John Ringley also was married to Frances Crockett at
right.
the time.
Frances Crockett.
JBL,
yes.
I know you're here with me, darling, and I hope you just, you know, where you're. When I'm talking to both of you, and probably enlightening you all. But John had also worked for us. Bill had brought him in, so he'd gotten out by that time, but he still stayed in the loop. By this time, Terry Garvin is up there working. That was another connection. So anyway, Vince, when I hear a lot of these stories, it's like Vince had all these rings. Well, later on he did, but when he first started out, he had no rings down here. Yeah. When Bill and my dad split, and when it came down to we had this television, and they paid the guy, and we paid $2,200 that day, and there was no film, and there was no film. We were done. We didn't have any TV. We didn't have anything. So Bill came in, swooped down, said, "This is what I'll give you, and I'll buy you out, and I want the chairs, and I want all the rings, and this is what I'm going to get." Well, he named X amount of rings. But he didn't name the one ring that I have that kept me going. And I said, this is one ring that my dad is going to have, because he always said, when I retire up the ranch, I want that wrestling ring sitting right there, you know, right that front door. He was, and that was where he wanted. So I grabbed the one wrestling ring, which there were seven of them that my dad had built back in the late 60s. They were a great working ring. It was an 18 by 18 free suspension ring. There's no spring, nothing. It was free suspension. And you put 2 by 12 by 18 boards on it. And you had steel cable ropes. So anytime that you put that cross underneath, you put those cables across, that would pop those posts out. And then you tighten up your tension with your turnbuckles. And you had some really stout, you had a stout ring. That was, hell, even the giant would say, that's the best ring I've ever been on, you know, because he could fall on it and it, you know, it was easy on him. So I kept that ring. So 82 was our last time. And by 83, senior died in 83. My first run was 1984. John Ringley called my parents and said, do you happen to have a ring? Because Junior is going, he has decided he's going to run opposition. He's going everywhere. And the first place he's going to be going is right there against Bill Watts. And he's going to go into the Oklahoma territory. Would you happen to have a ring? They were going to send somebody there. They were going to send somebody, fly him out here. And, boy, that's all I had to hear as a kid. I'm like, out back there, you know, I was at the ranch. And I said, that back 40, there's a wrestling ring right there. And it's sitting on that trailer, just like it's sitting right back here right now. And I said, I'm in. How much does it pay? And mom's like, oh, what are you going to do? You can't put up a ring. I'll find somebody. And my dad was like, you know, and I was like, heck, I'll find them. And I did. I started calling the old ring crew, one that can't drive anymore. I said, I don't care if you can't drive. I can drive. I just need you to lift steel up for me. Got the old Ballard Dodds, got him, and another guy he brought along, because that's a heavy ring. And away we go. So I accepted. The first time was in Oklahoma City. Well, I get to Oklahoma City and I got a ring and I'm waiting because I know I've got a payday coming. Not only that, I also know this business. These guys are flying in. They expect to have that ring ready to go, or we're not going to have a show. But the ring that was there was an old boxing ring that was set up on like stilts, you know, they were like jacks, and it was not going to sustain. There was no way. And it was not my ring. And that's not what. So I knew the guy, I knew the building manager from those days, Scott Munns. And I said, Scott, get this son of a bitch out of here. I said, I've got a ring and this is what I'm paid. I'm going to get paid to do this. This, we don't know anything about that. Well, we later find out that it was set to fail, and Scott was doing a deal, I guess, with Bill or who knows, but it was set to fall. It was, and it left. We get my ring crew in. I get there, and it just is getting up, just as Pat Patterson, my first agent that I met, and Pat's like, what the hell is going on here? This should have been set up here at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm like, Pat? And he goes, and who in the hell are you? You know, so, how do you do? How do you do, Mr. Patterson? I'm Mike McGurk, which didn't mean shit to him. You know, it was just like, he just wanted to make sure that, you know, are you responsible for the ring? Yes, I'm Mike. And okay, so now it's all filled in. We don't have cell phones. We don't have any of that. He's going by what that sheet of paper has, and I'm his contact. So that's how that first show started, was with my ring. Well, so Terry Garvin said, you did really well. We're going to go to Tulsa. So then it began. I went as, so that's how it went. I was ring crew before I became anything else. So I learned also too. I was like, well, how much is it to collect the jackets? Because I had this ring crew guy. I'd never been up at ringside. I'd never done that. That was for paying customers. I was back there with the hired help. You know, And so I said, well, hey, I'll ring the bell to keep time. And I got the ring crew guy. I'll dress him up a little bit, if you can do that. And he'll run the jackets. So that was meant for more money. So that's how all this kind of went, is that I'll be your one-stop show as far as the ring. And then it became, they were shipping merchandise down to me. And I was carrying the merchandise, these big old boxes. So I was carrying merchandise to these different towns and running opposition against Bill Watts. Huh. I ran opposition, and I think, and I ran as far as my North Dakota. I went as far east to see you, because I, you remember, I brought the ring to you a couple times, and you were just as wonderful as you've always been to me, Jerry. And I mean that, you know that, the Briscoes are dear to me. I went as far as Arizona. I was out at, and I can't, and of course, I can't tell you the Texas shows that I ran. Thank you very much. But when we'd go, he'd put me on these loops. And so I could get four or five shows while the guys were flying, or else that they would be driving. I'm leaving that show, taking that ring down, getting my ring crew, and we're driving all night long so I could at least get some sleep and then get up and get there by noon and get that ring up so that, you know, while you guys jetted around. And I was like, yeah, boy, I don't know where I made this deal. I used to tell it to the guys, because there one show he had me, we were in an afternoon show in Springfield, Illinois. And then I was supposed to be at Knoxville, Tennessee by 2 o'clock that following afternoon. Honest to God. And I made it. And not only that, we lose an hour. Or a game, right? We gain or lose, but I went into Eastern. I went from Central Time. Honestly, we went from snow. And I said, I feel like the freaking snow. I like the postman. I'm going from snow to sleet to rain. And now we're into Knoxville. And who do you think's there just going, where are you? Where are you? Chief Jay Strongbow. You know, Jay. And I go, hey, man, I haven't even stopped. I'm lucky to be here. And he, you know, it's business. I don't care. I don't want to hear about your sad story. I don't want to hear about the snow and stuff, just that you're here and got that ring up. So I did that. My first time to do announcing was only because, and it was Memphis, Tennessee, Mid-South Coliseum. Thank you, Elvis. It just, and it was on my mama's birthday, September 12th. And what happened there was, and what they'd been doing a couple of years is Vince would get and buy in, you know, trade out advertising with your local TV stations or your radio disc jockeys. So they, you know, they would, if this guy could get up and promote the station before the matches, and they worked out the advertising budget that way. Well, this one guy happened to be all about himself in Memphis, Tennessee this night. And I had Jack Lanza as the agent, and Jack is no bullshit. You know, I mean, it's with that clipboard and it's like, hey, and he came out there and I could see he was steaming. You know, he was like, get him out of there. I knew what this meant, you know, it was his neck or mine. And so I'm sitting there, I'm good. I've got all my stuff done. The music's great. I've got that lined up. I've you know, advanced to make sure all the boys' music is right. He comes in and he looks, and he comes back out there and he goes, come here. And he takes me to the back. And here's Andre. It was a big show. I think a Hawk. It was a really big show. They had sold, a really big show. They had sold out Memphis. And here, you know, all the people that I knew that were my, you know, that I always looked up to. And he's sitting there. And he goes, well, you know, you've sat out there. He said, you've announced, right? And I said, no. I had brought Dad and Mom. Because it was my mom's birthday. I brought Dad. We had rented this one time. Because other times I had a 3/4 ton Suburban that would haul this 1 ton ring. Well, this one time we rented, like, it was a van in the front, and then it had like the mini home in the back. It was all included. Wasn't quite a motor home, but it was like a mini home. But it also allowed my dad to be comfortable and sit, you know, instead of being in a car, he could get up, and then there's a bathroom there to make that trip. So anyway, I have all that there. And I'll never forget it, because he's like, well, you've done this, haven't you? I said, no, sir, no. And he goes, well, you're announcing tonight. He goes, because I've just pulled him. He's not going to be doing any of the announcing. I'm like, oh, my God. Oh my, I'm writing. I know these guys, but do I know their weight? And I knew that I was going to look like I could look right at you and go, oh, my God, who is that? Oh, my God, is that, you know, I knew you're JBL. I knew you're Jerry Briscoe. But at that moment, I didn't know my name. And because he had, you know, put it on me. And I got up there, and I did it. And my dad's great comment. He goes, "Didn't sound like a kid." And he's, because I was about 5 octaves higher. I was scared out of my wits. Are you kidding? You know, to be able to pull it off and do something right. Not only that, my biggest critic was right out there in the audience, and it was my daddy. So, but it, I wanted him on the road to know and to be around the boys, because he could go around the back, and you know, Jerry, JBL, that you, it just made him smile. You know, he would love to be a part of that. That made, it makes anybody, it's like us talking, and you know, you have those endearing stories that you it brings you back. Those are happy times. And the boys, it's a camaraderie that I don't know, but I understand a little bit, because I've never had any brothers, and you guys are my brothers. Always have been. You're my family. I can be in any different genre, any different kind of workspace, and somebody mentioned wrestling, I'm on. I mean, it's because it's my life. I was raised into it, and I know what you all have gone through, and I'm proud of it. I'm proud of all of everybody. And how could I not? How could I not be? And I said, God, the people that I've had the opportunity to meet in my life, I would have never had. And the characters, you know, I mean, it was Showtime, and that was a little bit of it. It was Showtime. And, that's where I started. And I didn't get Vince's attention probably for a couple of years, but it took getting, you know, Jack was good with it. You know, Blackjack, you know, Lanza was good with it. Tony Gurria, I want him over finally. He was a tough one. Renee, you know, just do your job. But they, you know, we weren't divas. We didn't know that name. Sherry and I didn't know it. And good God, you know, there's many a times that, you know, you found wherever you could to get dressed. You just, that wasn't provided, because I didn't care. I didn't want to make waves, because I wanted to stay. You know, the less waves that I make, then I'm going to get to, I'm going to get to hang in there. So don't make any waves. Well, I ran into Sherry, and that did it. Boy, that did it. But, you know, she started, that's another interesting story that I could tell you that I didn't know. You remember Mike? It was Mike Boyette. She started out with him. Yeah. So JBL, I can tell you, I mean, I know I've aged myself way, way, but it's wonderful memories. But how I got started that way, and the ring was over time, and that I had the ring, and that with each time that I did, each time opened each door, just like the Memphis thing, because he told me, he said, you know, you're going in opposition, and they, without a ring, there won't be a show. So if you don't get that ring up, it's on you. Well, that's a pretty big order. You know, that means come hell or high water, you're there. You're going to take this little girl out? Are you going to take that old bald headed man out that looks like he could be from the state penitentiary? I don't think so. And
you remember the story on how you got, yeah, I think you did Pentacola for me, but you're exactly right. No ring, no show. We were running Pensacola. Had Hogan had the A card up there. We get there. We'd hired out Frankie King, great Mephisto, who I love to death. Frankie was paid off by the local. I think it was the Jarretts and Lawler paid him off not to show up there. So we didn't have a ring there. So we went over to the local high school and got some wrestling mats and tied some ropes up around them. We actually had a show on amateur wrestling matches, John, in the early days of Pensacola. So, Mike, without that ring, you're right, man. It was hard on the boys, but you know what? They improvised and they got through it. But, Mike, John and I just, man.
You know what I'm going to say, JBL, don't you? You know where I'm, you know, there's a lead-in right there. It's like, God dang it, Briscoe, didn't you know? Mike Leroy's daughter bring that ring to you. You ought to know that. And what happened is we were going against Tennessee, and I've got a Harley Race story to tell you. When I went up there, and you got to realize, which I knew, but I think I was thinking so much as the show's must go on, because I was in that whole realm. I went from promoter's daughter, selling tickets, selling programs. That's what I did. And to know the business all the way around, with exception of being in the ring and my body, but I knew the whole the whole outer rim of it. Like you said, you've got to start with the ring and you've got to trust who's putting it up because those guys' bodies are on it and they're taking hits. They're going to be, you know, using those ropes. Oh my God. You know, it was like, they better, you know, I knew, but you always, every time that, you know, if you had, God, we had it. Oh my God. I tell you, I was, he sent me to a racetrack in Nashville, Tennessee, and we had, John Studd, we had Andre, and I'm thinking, oh my God, are the ropes going to hold? Oh my, you know, I'm not, I'm worried about the ring, but also too, for the guy's sake, you know, is that was the thing is doing it. But what happened in Kansas City, you know, I'm, this was big. This was Hulk Hogan. He got the, I think he had the key to the city, the whole thing. And Harley, I think he saw me out in the arena. He came up and he asked me, he said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I brought the ring. And he kind of looked at me. He was, you brought the ring. I said, Harley. And I said, out there in that minivan is Leroy. And I said, I know daddy would love to see you. And he just sat there and he said, God damn it. And I said, well, what? And he said, do you realize what the hell you and this Vince McMahon is doing? He said, I've bought into this territory. This is my life. And I said, well, I didn't tell you that you couldn't work for Bill Watts. And I said, I adore you. Your career, everything. But I said, Harley, let's just talk about it. I said, I've got a job to do. I'm sorry for this, but I mean, it's happening. And I said, Vince is going and he's going, he's not stopping. And if it's not me, it's going to be somebody else. And I said, what you need to do is go there and talk to my dad and let me finish up with the ring. He shows me a quart jar, like out of a mayonnaise jar, no label on it, anything. It was clear, but it had a pinkish tint to it. Does anybody know what that does? I didn't, but it was meant to go throw on that ring. It was meant but he goes, this will mess your ring up. It'll F your ring up. I don't know if it was meant to steal or what it would do, but it was meant for damage. And I said, well, maybe that'll, you just hang on to that little jar and go out there and talk to my dad. I get it. You know, I understand. And he, you know, asked me again, he said, do you realize what you're doing? I said, if I did, and probably the, you know, if I put the element of danger in it, but I said, I'm not thinking danger. I'm thinking of two, you know, what do they say that?
Hell, you, know, you would have still done it, Mike. You know that. You're McGurk.
I'm hard-headed. Yeah. I was hard-headed. And it was a challenge for somebody to say, a woman hauling the ring and doing this. Yeah. And a lot of times the building people would be, you know, because I'd come in there in sweats or anything. I'm not about the show until it's showtime and I'd get paid for it. So I'd get in there and the building people would go, where's that other lady that came in with the ring crew? I said, oh, we keep her in the dressing room. We don't let her out. So, and it was me. So I would do this, you know, the metamorphosis into the makeup and the hair and the tuxedo. But that I started that. But before I even did the announcing, I was still showing up in men's tuxedos. So when I was at the ring or anything like that, to dress up, because that gave it, you know, you that gave it authenticity. It gave it some class. You dressed up. I didn't care about what everybody else did, because anybody that comes in and, you know, you're used to seeing jeans or you're used to seeing this and you see somebody dressed, that's, you know, hey, that's focus. So, I mean, that was daddy too, you know, daddy was always a really well-dressed person. So he said, when you go up and you're out there and you're in the public eye, he said, you dress it. It doesn't matter if you're eating beans, you know, and back and it is, but you dress like you're $1 million and you'll get the respect. And you do, you know, you're a figure of authority. So, yeah, that was a little wisdom from my dad about dressing. So I said, okay. So I rented a man's tuxedo from Al's Tuxedo in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I ran around with a long crotched man's tuxedo for a while until the sewing girls came on board. And we got into spandex and some colorful tuxedos. And I didn't ask Vince. It was just something that I was doing to change things up. Plus the fact really what I did is because I didn't have to worry about the dry cleaning bill anymore. And it was, you know, I could wash it at night and be ready to go the next day. So, but that's how that started, was from the ring to that call. And then with each time and then they put me through it, you know, it'd be eight shows of grueling long shows and tearing it down, putting it back up and away we go. So that started in 1984. I announced in 86 and then over time house shows. So I knew that anytime Jack was the agent that he would let me, you know, he would instead of anybody else, but I was the ring. He had not made any rings yet. There was not any big trucks coming out of New York. I did all of that up until, and truth be known, I'd already been on television for about a year and Vince took me, he said, I can't let you do the ring anymore. And it about killed me because that's money. You know, like, but why? And he said, I can't have my on-air ring announcer, you know, showing up with the bald-headed guy in the ring. He said, I just can't have that. And I said, okay, wonder if I don't go on the road with them. And he's like, by this time he had already had, his plan was in motion and he had the rings. And I get that. But yeah, those days, it was like, hey, we had a show and the ring, and that's how I got started. So, and then he brought me in the television thing. He wasn't quite sold on me being an announcer yet. So he brought me in as color commentator. So that I'm also the first female color commentator. But it turned into, because we had this guy, I was with Bruce Pritchard, and we were down there for the promoter Paul Bosch's. We were, you know, they hadn't quite made the deal yet, but Vince was there. We hadn't, you know, Paul was still a part of that promotion, and so I was doing color commentary, and I really didn't know what, you know, what they wanted to put me as is, which wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to at least ascertain that, hey, that, you know, and fill in the color. But they wanted to be, you know, you need to be at home having babies, blah, 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 and have an art, you know, this kind of argumenting thing. But it changed a little bit. I did do a little bit with Gorilla, and, you know, it was just unbelievable, because it not only was I out of my league, but that just to be in the presence of Gorilla, that was just wonderful, and calling a match. And I think that it still isn't. I don't think, especially in my mind, I had to look at what I'm thinking. How can I call a match, or not call it like in the ring, but how can I be color if I've never been in that ring with those guys? And that was where I myself probably X'd myself out of that, because I felt like I didn't have the authority, you know, by being able to do that. Being an announcer, that would be mine. That would, as Vince said, if you ever wanted anybody to listen to you, here's your chance. You've got the mic in your hand, go for it. So, yeah, but I know I go along and explain this, but when you ask me one question, it probably has about 20 answers. Plus the fact COVID just about, I got so lonesome about seeing and talking to anybody. And just seeing you all is such a joy. And to be able to, that you're interested, that you want to know some history. It's wonderful.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you so much. I mean, this is a true treat. And there's so much more we can talk about, but I don't want to keep you forever. But thank you so much. I mean, it's such a wonderful history, even though it's Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. It's such a wonderful history of all of that incredible.
You just had to put that in there.
Of course I did, because Jerry's on the of all that incredible territory, from your dad, who's one of the greatest champions of all time, to you coming in to being the first woman commentator and to be the ring announcer. There's so much wonderful history there, and you're such a great person. I've always enjoyed being around you, so thank you so much for coming on the show.
I thank you all, and I could go on, you know, this thank you could go 30 minutes of how I wish I had the virtual hug and that I want to see you all, because you realize how infinite, you know, our life is, and how you were, and from the first time that I met you, you didn't, you know, I didn't I just thought you were pretty cool, and you had those long horns on that Cadillac, and I mean, in the hat, and I was like, I gotta say, you're pretty sharp, and you had a little bit of smarts about you, you know, so that, you know,
just a little bit. I've been intertwined with you, and your family, my entire professional life, which is 3/4 of my life, and. I think back and how fortunate I was to come along, you know, to work with your dad, to work with the Jack Gotts, the Leo Vosses, the Skandor Akbars, and your wonderful mother, Dorothy. I mean, Dorothy, right? And so.
Right, yeah, Dorothy. Then you got Danny. Look at your brother. Look at the things that you've done, Jerry. And, you know, you've got such in your family. My God, that one boy of yours, if I was just younger, I'd have him. He's just, and he's good to Max.
Have
him. Yeah. You know how
you're
good he was.
Him right now.
Yeah. But we really appreciate you taking the time.
I love you all.
And when you go to Stillwater tomorrow, drop by the National Wrestling Hall of Fame now and see Leroy Smith. Tell him you and I and JBL. He loves JBL for some reason. JBL was inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in Waterloo, Iowa, Dan Gable Museum up there a few years back. So he knows John, but Leroy, as you know, that museum's a wonderful place that preserves. The wrestling history and Leroy, but you know, I hope your granddaughter grows up to be a cowpoke or a cowgirl and join that wonderful softball team program that the Cowboys have up there in Stillwater. So, yeah, my regards to your family there. You guys are my family and always will be. And I appreciate everything your family has done for me personally and for the wrestling business and as a whole. And without the McGurk promotion, McGurk family, there would be an awful big hole in that Midwest area out there for professional wrestling. So thank you for your time, and please join us again sometime down the road.
I love you all so much. Thank you. And that is just from the bottom of my heart. And I kind of, one more question. Is any of you going to go to Waterloo? Are you going to be in Waterloo?
I'm going.
Okay. I'm going to make my first trip. I want to go. I didn't get to go.
You'll see your dad's plaque on the wall there, and it's an inspiring thing. It really is. Thank you so much.
I love you all.